If you're a regular listener of Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, please rate and review us at the Apple Store using iTunes or the Podcasts app on your iPhone. And I want to give a special thank you to Star Lady and Frank424, who both just gave us 5-star reviews. Star Lady writes, "I love DBK and his choice of guests. Timely, topical, tremendously thoughtful. It's my go-to to get out of my head and appreciate other points of view. I listen to pick and choose opinions to arm myself with before intense social encounters like cons, because I know that I can count on reasoned arguments and detailed breakdowns of facts and factoids. It's having a friend you can always count on to be enthusiastic about what you love and to legitimize discussing what others might consider minutiae, but we know is deep and meaningful, the essence of truth and beauty." So big thanks again to Star Lady and Frank424 for their support. All right, so now let's get to our panel.
Wired.com presents The Geek's Guide to the Galaxy. And here is your host, David Barr Kirtley.
Hello, and welcome to episode 380 of Geek's Guide to the Galaxy. Today on the show, we'll be discussing overlooked science fiction and fantasy, and I'm joined by three guests. So first up, we've got Deserina Boscovich, who you may remember from our panel on Nameless Horrors back in episode 229. Her short fiction appears in Clark's World, FNSF, and Nightmare Magazine, and she's also the co-author of the Steampunk User's Manual. And we'll be speaking with her today about her new book, Lost Transmissions, The Secret History of Science Fiction and Fantasy. So, Des, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Then next up, we've got Paul Tremblay, making his fourth appearance on the show. He's the author of novels such as Disappearance at Devil's Rock and The Cabin at the End of the World, and the short story collection Growing Things and Other Stories. His novel, A Head Full of Ghosts, has been optioned for film, and his article, Behold the Science Fiction Cosmic Horror of Phase 4, appears in Lost Transmissions. So, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Happy to be back.
And also joining us today is Grady Hendricks, making his 17th appearance on the show. He's the author of novels such as We Sold Our Souls and My Best Friend's Exorcism, and nonfiction books such as Paperbacks from Hell. He also wrote the screenplay for the new feature film Satanic Panic. In his article, It's a Man's Apocalypse, appears in Lost Transmissions. So, Grady, welcome to the show.
Aloha.
All right, so let's start off with Des and have you just tell us about how this book, Lost Transmissions, came about.
Yeah, so it's so long ago now. We've been working on it for years, actually. But as you mentioned, I was the co-author of the Steampunk User's Manual together with Jeff Vandermeer, and when we were working on that, we worked with an amazing editor named David at Abrams Image. So the idea for the secret history of science fiction and fantasy was actually Jeff Vandermeer's idea originally, and it was sort of his baby for a while. And our editor, David at Abrams, was also very interested in it and really wanted to see it happen. But Jeff actually wasn't able to pursue it because, you know, he got too busy writing a bunch of New York Times bestselling novels. So they suggested that I could work on it. And I was really, really into the idea as well. It was just like filled with some of my favorite stuff that I really wanted to be able to research and talk about. And of course, I had worked with David originally, so I knew we worked well together on a project like that. And, you know, with a coffee table book, with all the imagery and stuff like that, there's a lot of admin and research that goes into it aside from the writing, which can be like a little bit of a different skill set. So they were confident that I could handle that since I had done a great deal of it already on the Steampunk User's Manual. So originally I was supposed to be co-authoring the book with Jason Heller, who was also tapped to work on it. And he's a fantastic music journalist who recently had a book come out about David Bowie and science fiction, rock and roll. So he joined me on the project originally, and we did a lot of brainstorming and outlining and ideating on that together. Unfortunately, he had to drop out. He had some personal stuff come out, so he wasn't able to see the project through to the end. So I just ended up taking it on myself, and that's the book that you have in your hands today.
And so now when you say it's the secret history of science fiction and fantasy, could you talk about what makes it secret and how did you decide what to include and what not to?
Yeah, so I think kind of the first idea would be works that were overlooked, that did not get their due at the time, that were not big popular blockbuster type works, but that nevertheless had a huge influence on the genre, because of other people who saw and absorbed those ideas and began to kind of carry them out in their own work. There's also things that never happened, but could have happened. So those works that were begun and for whatever reason canceled or abandoned. And then there's a little bit of just kind of behind the scenes type of stuff and impacts that you might not have known about, backstories you might not have heard. And there was, it was kind of, you know, to navigate that and figure out what the proper mix was kind of just a work in progress throughout the entire writing of the book. And, you know, there's a ton of stuff that I would have liked to include that I think would have fit very well in the book. But we just ran out of pages and time. And so I think there's a lot of other things that we could talk about. And I know you have some suggestions from listeners and all that kind of thing. I know people will look at the table of contents and say, like, why wasn't this included? And, you know, what's in the book is really not like, it wasn't, it's not better than that other stuff. It's not more special. It's just, that's what made it into the book. So I don't want it to seem like this is some sort of end all and be all of the secret history. And that is actually something that I talk about in the introduction to the book, is that I hope that reading that book will sort of inspire more secret histories and readers to kind of come up with their own taxonomy of the foundational works that define the genre for them without necessarily being those big blockbuster bestseller types.
Now, was there anything that you ever considered including or that was suggested to you that you decided not to include because, like, that's not secret enough, it's too well known to fit into this book?
Well, you know, originally I had sort of had the idea that we would explore maybe lesser known aspects of the big blockbuster type franchises. And a few contributors did work on essays like that. I had some ideas for essays like that. But then I think that once we saw everything we had together, we had to end up kind of cutting most of that, if not all of it, because it just didn't really work overall with how the book turned out. And I was sad about that because I did enjoy the pieces that I got that had gone more in that direction. But it just, the book as a whole, we realized it would just be stronger without kind of exploring that. One of the things I had thought to do was write a piece about the fashion of Doctor Who and kind of explore the process that goes into deciding what each new doctor would wear and, like, what their costume sort of would be and how their individual fashion kind of segues with who they are and their personality as their own manifestation or incarnation of the Doctor. And I was pretty into that, but unfortunately that piece did not make the cut for a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, so, you know, Paul and Grady and I all contributed pieces to this book. Could you just talk about, you know, how much of the book you wrote yourself and how you went about lining up other people to contribute material as well?
Yeah, so I think I don't know the exact breakdown. I think I wrote probably about 2/3 myself. And the other third, I would say, is contributors. And, you know, I had a long list of contributors, people that I know or just know of in the genre, who I was really interested to see what they had to say about stuff. I asked a lot of people, you know, and not everyone I asked was able to do it. So, again, there could be a whole other book, like this could also, there could also be a whole other alternate secret book with the people that were sadly too busy to take this on with the deadlines that we had.
That would be Lost or Transmissions?
Yeah, basically. So, you know, I think I wrote a lot of the literature section myself because that's the areas where I had the most knowledge and passion. And then areas like fashion, I think they're pretty much all contributed by other people who had more expert things to say about it than I did. Same like with a lot of the fandom chapter, a lot of those were by outside contributors. So, you know, I just tried to find a mix of people with different perspectives and experience who could write about their own favorite things in a way that excited them, and really left it up to the contributors pretty much to write whatever they wanted to write, like what they were excited about.
Yeah, yeah. Since Chris, so let's get some of the contributors in here. So Paul, talk about being approached by Des and how you decided to write the essay that you did.
Sure. So, I mean, Des Rainer approached me, you know, basically told me the pitch. He was looking for overlooks, did not get their due. And, you know, and also the part about, you know, is there sort of like an ongoing influence or is there, you know, like ripples from, you know, from this piece of work that you wanted to discuss? So I knew what I wanted to write about almost instantly, just because, you know, coincidentally enough, I feel like I've had this conversation within horror writing circles for a few years now. But, geez, I don't have it in front of me since I wrote the essay. But is it 1972 or 73? The movie Phase 4 by Saul Bass. It's the only movie that Bass directed. You know, for decades he was he worked in design. There was also like a fun, you know, if you want to go online to look up, you know, different conspiracy theories, there is one that that he did. Well, he did do the storyboard apparently for, you know, the famous scene, the shower scene in Psycho. But I guess for a few years he was claiming that he actually directed that scene and not Hitchcock, which, you know, based on the research that I did, most people quickly were able to prove that that wasn't the case. But it is sort of like a fun little side piece about the movie Phase 4. Anyway, to me, my big, besides, you know, really liking the movie and enjoying it, because I don't think there's any other movie out there like it, is I do think there's a strange ripple effect throughout modern horror or weird fiction, particularly as portrayed by cosmic horror. I think most of my colleagues who do write cosmic horror sort of chafe, or maybe not all of them do, but I know quite a few chafe at the idea that all cosmic horror is Lovecraftian. That's like sort of the birthplace of cosmic horror, which, you know, clearly is not the case. And actually, if you read, if you read Lost Transmissions, you get to read Des's wonderful article on Robert W. Chambers. But with Phase 4, the idea of these like super intelligent ants, basically getting a sort of a new intelligence based off of the movie hints, like there's like some sort of like, not a solar flare, but some sort of like pulse from outer space. You know, there's some sort of cosmic event. And then after that happens, these all ants on Earth sort of gain this like super consciousness or a combined consciousness. You know, just how the movie is filmed and how it's portrayed, particularly the end. There's some really cool big ideas. You know, some of the acting in the direction, you know, isn't the best and doesn't hold up. I mean, I think we can cut Saul Bass a little bit of slack because he's clearly not a director. But visually, I mean, that's his bailiwick. It's stunning. And I've talked to, you know, Laird Barron and Livia Llewellyn and a few other people about how I can see, before I'd even talk to them about the movie, I told them, hey, you're probably a big fan of Phase 4 because I can see some influence. And both of those right away were like, oh, yeah, definitely love Phase 4. In Laird's short or novelette 30 in particular, which became a recent movie called They Remain, directed by Phil Gillette. And even that movie, they almost use some of the look of Phase 4. Like in Phase 4, there's a sort of a white paneled geodesic dome in the middle of the desert. And in They Remain, there's a bunch of tents that look like three or four geodesic domes, you know, put together. So anyway, for me, it was fun to talk a little bit about that crossover from sci-fi to horror.
Now, I've never heard of this movie before, although I'm not a huge horror expert. Is this a movie that you had to go out of your way to find, or was there some unusual way that you came across it? Or
it's funny, I cannot remember how I saw it first, but I think like most things, I mean, I'm a child of the 80s. Like, you'd be surprised by how many of these movies were just on network TV when I came home from school, in the middle of the afternoon. Grady and I are close to the same age, I think, and maybe he could, you know, I would come home and see like Devil Dog Hound from Hell was on like CBS or, you know, the same with Phase 4. And I think my father might've mentioned it to me because, I mean, like the movie poster makes it look more horror than it is. It definitely is more of a, like, in terms of the ideas of, you know, the how of the ants and how they communicate, there is actually sort of like a fascinating rudimentary piece about how this mathematician, one of the characters, is trying to communicate with the ants, you know, which you get a much better treatment of by, you know, Ted Chiang in Arrival, which is the adaptation of is The Story of Your Life, right? So to me, I don't know, there's all these fun little, I don't know, if not full-blown rivers, but little brooks into other works that come out of Phase 4.
Yeah, well, let's get Grady in here. So, Grady, have you ever seen Phase 4, and can you tell me how obscure is it, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I love Phase 4. It's great. They you know, they've done re-releases of it in the last 10 years. I think, was the new ending discovered around 2012, Paul?
Yes, or 2011 or 2012, yes.
Yeah, and I think that sparked a bunch of re-releases, and ever since then, programmers just keep slotting it into psychedelic retros or sci-fi retros or horror retros. It's a great movie. But yeah, it was pretty obscure before then. I mean, it played on TV and stuff some, but it's really hard to come by. And it's weird. Like, I was really, really happy to see Paul talk about Jodorowsky and the ending feeling like Jodorowsky. You go in expecting a horror movie and you get this like total Ant-Man psychedelic freak out. You know, it's a groovy film. But that's also one of the things I think is like, well, anyways, that's a separate thought, but yeah, no, Phase 4 is amazing.
Well, I mean,
I was really happy to see it.
Did you see it on TV, Grady, or like,
no,
growing up?
I saw it my mom was really against cable and R-rated movies. So I missed out on so much stuff growing up. I only saw Phase 4 like 5 years ago and it blew my mind.
Huh. Well, so Grady, why don't you tell us about your article too? It's a man's apocalypse.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, I don't remember, Dez, did you approach me or was I like lobbying you for this?
What?
I can't remember.
I'm pretty sure I approached you.
Okay.
I don't remember being lobbied by anyone, unfortunately.
Well, I think when you mentioned the project to me, I was like, nah, I don't know anything. You know, sci-fi, fantasy, horror's my thing. But then I started thinking about, oh, shit, there are all these amazing post-apocalyptic men's adventure novels, and they're sci-fi. I mean, they all take place after a nuclear war, and they're all from the 80s. And, you know, I was really... It's hard. My nephews, I try to tell them, I mentioned the Cold War and they're like, yeah, that was stupid. And I'm like, well, I mean, yeah, but also like for those of us who grew up during it, like you really did feel like, without trying to sound melodramatic, that it was like a 50-50 proposition. You were making it to the drinking age. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, there was a real feeling that you could just die tomorrow. And my dad really loved talking about it. Like, he was like, he would be like, you know, just like out of the blue, you know, we lived in Charleston, South Carolina. He'd be like, you know, we're part of the top 10 first strike list for the Soviet Union. And there are over a dozen ICBMs aimed at us right now. So when a nuclear war happens, you'll have about 30 minutes and then we'll all be dead. And I was like, you know, I was like seven. And like, it really like, and so that kind of stuck with me, you know, like your dad telling you could die in 30 minutes and not, he's like, you wouldn't even know the missiles are on their way. I'm like, what the fuck, man? So these post-apocalyptic men's adventure novels, they all started coming out in the early 80s and they were like, you know, all of them, the first one was Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist, and they were all dudes with guns and a lot of hardware. Women were maybe Amazonian biker gangs who were harvesting men's sperm for their own nefarious purposes. But like, it was dudes with guns fighting mutants in the rubble. And it was like, on the one hand, the world is bleak and people are killing each other the last can of Spam. On the other hand, these guys lived in these amazing underground fallout shelters that like were air conditioned and had shag carpets and they survived and they like scored with any chicks and they like could do whatever they wanted and like shoot crossbows with dynamite on the arrows. Like, wait, the Warlord series has a crossbow on every cover.
Let me ask you, Grady, were these published by science fiction publishing houses or
no?
Not?
No, these were all coming out of the men's adventure market. So it was stuff like, I think Gold Eagle was one of them. Zebra published a bunch of them. But, I mean, like Berkeley would publish some and stuff, but it really came out of the men's adventure market, you know, which was like The Executioner and books like that. And Bronson, Silent Rage and stuff. So they weren't aimed at sci-fi readers either. They were aimed at people who wanted to read about dudes with guns, you know, and so, and for an 11-year-old boy, which is about the age I discovered them, like, That's everything I want in a book. No women, lots of guns, lots of violence. The world is over, so there's no homework. So, and they're really not considered part of the sci-fi canon, right? I mean, like,
yeah, I mean, I've never heard of any of these.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like you're saying, like, you know, you're like, oh, they're survivalists. Survivalists ran for, like, I don't know, man, 29 books. Like, there was, oh, God, CADS, which was about dudes in powered armor in a post-apocalyptic America. And at one point, they, like, a gang of inmates in a mental institution break out, and they give their doctor, like, an acid enema, like acid, like, that'll eat through your skin. And then they crucify him and put him on the front of a school bus and drive around killing people while dressed as clowns and stuff. Like, that's sci-fi. Like, you know what I mean? These dudes are fighting them in Iron Man outfits. It ran for like 12 volumes. There were some Deathlands, I think, or From the Ashes. I mean, these things ran for like sometimes 30 volumes, 40 volumes. So it's a significant chunk of literary output. This all takes place in a science fiction setting, but it's not generally considered science fiction.
Well, and I thought it was interesting, Grady, how you point out that this genre sort of died out after the Cold War.
Oh, yeah.
But you say it was sort of reborn as the zombie survival genre.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You read The Walking Dead, and The Walking Dead is a post-apocalyptic men's adventure novel that's like woke. Like, you know what I mean? It's like there are women in it, and people have conversations, and like they don't just blow people away, and they ponder big issues. And, you know, and it's very like the cast is very diverse, which are all great things, but are like toxic to the men's adventure post-apocalyptic novel books. But so that's like a more modern sort of rendition of the same kind of trope. Thinking about a world that's been destroyed where you don't have to punch a clock, but somehow you magically survived and can kill as many people as you want because they're either radioactive mutants, communist scum, or zombies. That's always been popular and always will be.
It's funny, Grady, you know, because my girlfriend Stephanie, for a while, she was doing publicity for this small press called Permuted Press that publishes mostly zombie novels. And there was a huge crossover, it seems, between their authors and survivalism and stuff like that. And sometimes, you know,
there's one
author where they're like, oh, we need to get in. Does anyone know how to get in touch with this guy? He's just like, we need to get in touch with him for a contract or something. He's just like off the grid. Like nobody knows where he is or how to find him.
Yeah. And can I just say something separate about the book? Do you mind?
About Lost Transmissions?
Yeah, Lost Transmissions.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Like, one of the really, really great things about this book is, like, you know, canons are really, really important. And I think they're really important in genre. And I don't think they're so important in, like, mainstream literary fiction. But in genre, they're really, really important. But often canons come early. And so the people who form them are usually white dudes. Nothing wrong with white dudes. I'm a white dude. But, like, they're usually formed by white dudes. And they're usually formed by people who are really enmeshed in the fandom culture. They know the grudges. They know the rivalries. And they're very, very focused on what's essential to that genre's fandom. What's essentially sci-fi, and no, that's not sci-fi because that's too many fantasy elements. And that stuff's important because, like, it gives everyone a framework to build off of. Well, now I'm going to argue with the canon. Now I'm going to write something that's against, you know, and all that stuff. But what I really like about Lost Transmissions is this is the important work of coming in later and looking back and pulling in people who straddled genres and pulling in people who weren't just white dudes. And I don't mean that in sort of let's fill a quota kind of way, but I mean it's important in the sense of to understand a genre's history, you have to understand and remember the people who weren't written in that history, who are usually people of color and usually women, just because that's how it happens. So to see something like this, which includes like Claire Noto, who wrote The Tourist, or Kathy Acker, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, or Janelle Monáe, or Angela Carter in a conversation about science fiction and fantasy is so huge and so inspiring, not in the sense of, oh, it'll inspire this young woman to go out and fight the system, but it'll inspire authors everywhere, men, women, gay, straight, black, white, whatever, to look up these works and like get inspired by these offshoots that never went anywhere, and these cul-de-sacs and dead ends and these sort of mutants. Like Phase 4, man, horror is so up its own cul-de-sac right now. It would do a lot of horror directors good to go back and be like, oh wait, insects, they're pretty fucking scary and weird. I could do something with that. So I think something like this is so hugely important. And Des, I assume my check's in the mail.
Well, I mean, you described it exactly. I mean, that's exactly it. Like, just there's so much valuable, incredible, inspirational stuff that for whatever reason did not get its due. And a lot of it is the fact that they were coming at it from a different perspective that was not that mainstream white dude perspective. But when you look back at that stuff now, it's incredibly innovative. It's incredibly groundbreaking. And you talk about the inspiration that those people can have on writers, creators, storytellers now, and that's definitely true. But the truth is that those people were secretly, privately, quietly influencing the genre this whole time, because people did read those stories and people did take all that in and regurgitate it in their own work. Just those figures that influenced them, they just didn't happen to make it onto those top 10 or top 100 lists. That is sort of how we define the canon when we think about it.
I wanted to ask you, Des, you know, there, this book has an introduction by Jeff Vandermeer, and there's two parts in the book. At one point, he says, you know, I never would have guessed, to be honest, when I first encountered Isaac Asimov, that he was practically a household name. And later in the book, he says, Angela Carter stands among the greatest of all 20th century fantasists, eclipsing lesser talents such as Bradbury or Ellison. I was just curious, so what you thought reading that. Do you have a similar perspective to that? That you know, some of these people get a lot of attention, you know, get more attention than they really need, or like, where do you fall on that scale of like how much has the canon matched what deserves attention, you know, over the decades?
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I would really consider myself, you know, an authority who could say what deserves or doesn't deserve attention. But I would say I continue to be only somewhat educated in the canon as we, you know, typically talk about it. And I would agree that the writers who I consider most essential to my own kind of development as both a reader and writer of genre are not those guys. Probably the one that comes to mind, I think the first like science fiction and fantasy that absolutely blew my mind was books by Sylvia Engdahl that I like just found at the public library when I was a very small girl. And I don't know if any of you have read Sylvia Engdahl. She primarily writes.
I don't think I've ever heard of Sylvia Engdahl.
I really should have put her in the book. I'm just like, damn it, why didn't? But that's what I mean about how there could be a whole other book.
Were they published by science fiction publishing houses?
I think so. I mean, she primarily wrote YA, and I think it was maybe even YA that was maybe more targeted at a young female audience. I'm really not sure. But my MO when I was a child, you know, we would have like a sort of like every couple weeks we'd go to the library, like the public library, and just like stock up. And I lived in a pretty rural area, so it was a pretty small library. So there was just like this one long shelf of science fiction and fantasy, and I kind of just slowly worked my way through it. So, I mean, that's just sort of how I discovered the authors that shaped me, and I didn't really have a sense of how famous or not famous they were, whether or not they were canon. I was just pulling off stuff from the shelf. And oh my gosh, those Sylvia Engdahl books just like blew my mind. Like, just there was a twist that I just thought was the most incredible, amazing twist I had like ever encountered in literature before. And I still think about it, and I feel like that kind of thing just like really shaped me.
Sorry, what book is that?
Oh my gosh, I can't remember now, and I've looked it up a bunch of times to remember. I think it might have been like something like Star of Light, but and that might be wrong. Another book she wrote that was really popular was called Enchantress from the Stars.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, just when you're saying like, you know, I'm always astonished by people who haven't read those authors who are considered canon. Like, in 10 years, I think it's going to be hard to find a sci-fi fan who's read Asimov or Heinlein or even, like, Ray Bradbury. I feel like these guys get so... And, like, I think I like them all, but, like, they really do. Authors get forgotten. I mean, that's the fate of authors, right? We all wind up on the remainder table and then nowhere.
Man, I don't know if I've ever read Asimov, to be honest, either. I mean, I have, I'm sure, but... I couldn't like bring to mind like, oh, this is my favorite Asimov story. I have read Bradbury. Bradbury used to be my sister's favorite author, and we shared a lot of books, so I have read him. Yeah, so then another author that I would consider kind of foundational to my own personal science fiction and fantasy canon is Tanith Lee, and that's a similar type of thing. Like when I was in, except I was in college, but I also just like trolled the library and pulled off stuff that looked interesting. And I just stumbled on her work. And her work was also very foundational for me as a writer. So if you ask me about my canon, like those would be two female science fiction writers that I consider fundamental to it. And, you know, who've played a much bigger role in my development as a reader and writer than I would say, you know, Bradbury and people like that have done.
Yeah. Paul, what were you going to say?
You're talking about personal canons, and I was, you know, it's funny, you're talking about how, you know, how many writers coming up either now or soon, you know, haven't read Bradbury was considered canon. And I was just sort of left wondering, it's like, geez, well, how many writers are coming up now whose exposure is mainly like a totally other, you know, it's not necessarily writing, it's film and television. I feel like that was how, and I feel like maybe I was sort of at the start of a time period where that could happen. I was born in 1971. So for whatever reason, cable TV came to my town fairly early. I would say like in 1980, 1981. So I distinctly remember as a kid, like going to a movie, like actual theater. You know, my dad worked in a toy factory. My mom was a bank teller. So we weren't going to the, you know, if we went to the movies, it was a big deal. But now all of a sudden with cable television, I think, there was an explosion in the 80s, you know, similar, you know, obviously not as much content as we have now with streaming, but I think there was a similar almost like revolution in terms of the amount of movies that were now available to more people. And also like, so not every movie had to be like this giant blockbuster. So the movies that I sort of really grew up on, you know, so even before, you know, even though I'm a horror writer, like most of the stuff I watched in the 80s was science fiction and really sort of like trashy science fiction or fantasy. You know, I think of something like the movie Trancers. I don't know if either of you have seen that movie. It actually spawned like a bunch of sequels that I've never watched. But the original 1984, you know, I haven't seen it in a long time, but it was a mix of noir, science fiction. There was even like a little zombie thing, but there was also like this weird like time travel. Or a movie like Starman. I'm thinking of the movies that, you know, were on HBO like 24/7. I think that's another movie that I think has really, you know, if not impacted a lot of people, but certainly, you know, people sort of our age, if Gen Xers are sort of, you know, if a lot of writers now are Gen Xers, I'd be really surprised if they haven't seen that movie, if they're working in genre.
That's an interesting point, and Grady was sort of getting at too, is, you know, are any books, you know, not overlooked to some extent. I mean, like one thing I think about a lot is, you know, my favorite author growing up was Roger Zelazny. And there was this article in The Guardian one time, I actually went and looked it up. But, you know, there was this article and it said, you know, it was talking about Lord of Light, and it said Zelazny and Lord of Light are pretty much forgotten now, but blah, blah, blah. And somebody wrote a letter to the editor protesting, saying, Roger Zelazny's not forgotten. He's like a legend in science fiction and all this stuff. He's won all these awards. You know, people still talk about Lord of Light and so on. But, you know, like growing up with him as my favorite author, I would say it was pretty rare that I would ever meet anyone.
Yeah.
Who'd ever.
find me someone who's read Nine Princes in Amber.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it might be interesting even just to say which authors aren't. are sort of, safe from the categorization of overlooked. Yeah, you could maybe say, like, Asimov, Bradbury, Clark, maybe William Gibson. But, I mean, like, when I talk to people who aren't hardcore fantasy and science fiction readers, you know, they've maybe heard of, like, four or five authors, and that's pretty much it.
But it's funny, though, right? Like, I feel like often genre doesn't own its biggest successes. Like, you know, Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House, that's owned by horror, but like Toni Morrison's Beloved, horror doesn't own that. Like it doesn't say this is a great horror novel. It is part of the top 100 horror novels of all time. Horror doesn't act like it owns Twilight. You know, science fiction doesn't act like it owns The Hunger Games. Fantasy doesn't act like it owns Harry Potter. Those genres seem to consider those huge successes almost a separate thing. Harry Potter is Harry Potter. Like, you know, like, I don't know, maybe I'm a little wrong about it, but that's always the feeling I've gotten.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, when you say genre, it's funny, I imagine, like, the fantasy genre as like an anthropomorphized thing sitting in the corner.
Right.
And saying, no.
Well, I'm thinking of like Reader Connor,
well, especially
Oscar,
in, yeah, no, I, yeah, I mean, especially in horror, where it is such a small, you know, insular community, which can be fun in some ways, because I think it can come up with some, you know, wonderful outsider art. But, you know, other times, as you said, it can sort of certainly get into its own navel gazing. But I don't know, like, Grady, I'm sure you're to the point, and Desarena too, where you go to a convention that's not just a genre convention, it's, you know, a general literary convention. And I don't know, I can tell you so many times where, like, when people ask what I write, you know, if I tell them I write horror, eyes glaze over. Or, you know,
oh, yeah,
the only writer they know of is, you know, maybe Stephen King. Or
yeah,
if you bring up another writer, like, oh, yeah, they wrote horror, maybe. So it is interesting. I mean, it's almost, it feels like sometimes that the conversations that we have, only like small groups of people are allowed to have them. But that doesn't mean that they're less important, because they clearly, because they, but at the same time, you know, who we're talking about, you know, in this book as well, Lost Transmissions, have had such a large impact on our culture, even if most people don't realize it.
Well, and I think there's a sense in which if you're really into something, you don't want to identify with the most popular. You know, you don't want to say, I'm a hardcore fantasy fan. I like Harry Potter. You know, like anyone, like everyone likes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I want to get Des back in here too. But like, Des, you want to talk about that? Like this, like appeal of like overlooked things. You want, you don't want to just like the same thing everybody else likes.
You know, I was kind of just thinking about it as you were talking, because just as I was working on this book, you know, I'm like, I am well acquainted with sort of how nerds act, being a nerd myself and having been to many conventions. And so I just like, I knew there would be a specific audience for this book that would enjoy the book, but also just constantly be scoffing at the idea that these things are obscure. You know, sort of like, oh, everyone's heard of blah, blah, blah. Like, how could you say that's secret? Or how could you say that's overlooked? So I just kind of had to, like, let that little voice go that I knew that, like, for some people who are truly experts in the genre, these things will not be secret or overlooked. But for many people, they will be, and they will be learning something new when they read this. And just realize, you know, not everything can be the right thing for all people. And that's kind of been, you know, I've kind of seen some of the early response to the book. Of course, it just came out a week and a half ago. But, you know, I've seen that in sort of how people have responded, where a few people have said, like, oh, why is this in the book? Like, everyone knows about that. But most of the people who encounter the book are like, wow, that's pretty obscure. So it's just like what you're saying, it really all kind of comes down to your perspective and how well-versed you are in genre. But we also have to keep in mind that, you know, people, there's a lot of different generations now working in genre, and they have very different ideas often about what is canon and what is obscure and that kind of thing. And I think probably the book as a whole might appeal a little bit more to a younger audience that is coming at things with a more Gen X or millennial perspective.
Well, one of the things in the book, I mean, some of them are not themselves particularly obscure, like Star Wars, but the book focuses on lesser known aspects of that.
Yes.
And I mean, I do this like full time. I mean, I would think of myself as pretty well informed, but most of the stuff in the book was news to me. And even stuff like, I'm kind of surprised I never knew it, but the thing about war, like Ronald Reagan watching War Games.
Yeah.
And
that's fun,
you know,
right?
And saying we need to actually have cybersecurity. Like, I can't believe I never heard that before. That's an amazing story about a pretty well-known movie, you know.
But, you know, I mean, a lot of stuff I did debate, like, oh, I mean, like, Angela Carter's a good example. Like, I mean, I would consider Angela Carter foundational, but she, I mean, to be fair, she, at least in America, she doesn't get a lot of respect within genre.
Yeah.
So I wanted to include her. But some people would say, oh, everyone knows her. So, like, why is that in there? And, you know, that's a fair perspective. Earlier you did ask me, Dave, like, was there something that I decided was too well known to include? And another thing I thought about that kind of fits that was Samuel Delaney's Dahlgren, because I think that was something I originally wanted to talk about, because I actually have read Dahlgren, so I wanted
Whoa.
To write about it. I know, right? But it's kind of a weird thing where everyone's heard of Dahlgren, but not a lot of people have read it. But in the end, I decided, I mean, Samuel Delaney, he is really very, you know, he's very well known. He really is one of the giants of the genre. It's a tough book, but I don't think it's necessarily obscure. And I don't know. I mean, all those decisions kind of, maybe you're right, maybe they're wrong. There's a lot of canons. So yeah, I ended up not including it. And that's also just because the literature section was getting so overstuffed compared to other areas of the book that my editor was like, you need to calm down with literature.
I guess I want to ask, you know, like Paul, for example, I mean, when you get together with other super hardcore fans, do they mostly know the things that are your favorites or not? Because I would say my taste within fantasy and science fiction are relatively mainstream for fantasy and science fiction fans. And right. Even I have a hard time, even at a science fiction convention, finding people to talk about my favorite things with.
Well, it's fine. I mean, typically, you know, because, you know, my focus tends to be horror. I mean, we sort of discuss the hell out of horror works. In fantasy and science fiction, you know, other than maybe sort of like the most famous ones, don't come up a ton. So it was kind of fun for me, you know, in preparation for this, you know, podcast, to sit and think about my childhood. And I was like, I didn't realize like how many, you know, fantasy science fiction movies that I did watch, and probably actually more than horror. Cause I mean, when I was a kid, horror scared the living shit out of me. particularly fantasy. I feel like fantasy in the '80s and probably the '90s was in this weird place. And I think fans that are millennial or younger would have a hard time recognizing, certainly film and television, where fantasy was, because it was really not, those movies didn't do well. There really wasn't a ton of them. They certainly weren't as popular as Lord of the Rings, and certainly what's, you know, the ginormous explosion of Game of Thrones. But I don't know. I mean, Grady and Des can jump in, but, you know, the fantasy movies that I saw like a million times as a kid were like Krull, the Beastmaster, which I think, you know, played at least twice a day on HBO. I can't tell you how many times I watched both those movies. Then there was, you know, the weird stuff like John Borman's Excalibur, which, you know, when I saw it as a teenager was like a really, or like a 12-year-old was like a really risque thing to watch because it was so violent and full of sex. But like, I don't know, it felt like in retrospect, almost like this punk little thing that was happening. Like these movies now had a place to be seen. They weren't like big budget movies. They were like all these almost like small, you know, just really enthusiastic people, often mixing genres, you know, before a time where we would openly discuss, hey, you know, this mixes genres. And it was really some wild stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other place where I feel like that was happening in the 80s, because we're pretty much the same age, yeah, is computer games. Like, Infocom was so freaking formative for me. You know, they did those text-based games, and there was like, they started out with the Zork ones that were fantasy and moved on to like sci-fi ones. They wound up doing the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game. But that their sort of smart-ass sense of humor, their sort of Monty Pythonisms, their real British humor influence while doing genre material, that was huge to me. You know, the idea of world building and like, you know, your main character can go into this world. It's what, how they interact with the world that's interesting, not their particular backstory, because their backstory is you. You know, that was huge to me. The choose your own adventure books that, yeah, went, there's a sci-fi one, there's a horror one.
I was so into those.
Yeah, me too. Paul, you weren't?
No, I definitely read some of those. Again, I was more of a TV person, but if I do, yeah, read anything of my own volition, yeah, as a kid, it was definitely the choose your own adventures.
Well, yeah, and it was hard growing up too, like in the 80s, you had no idea how popular really anything was, you know, like,
right,
there were so many things that I like, the like those computer games, the adventure games that I played growing up, or some of the role-playing games, that I was like, these are so amazing, everybody outside my lame town must know about this, right? But then later,
King's
I
Quest,
saw, you know,
yeah,
some of those they topped out at 100,000 units,
yeah,
or something, you know, and that's the, all the, you know, only that number of people ever came across this at all.
Yeah. I mean, like, you look at, like, you go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, you know, in the book, there's one computer game mentioned that I can think of is Bioforge. And I was just curious, Des, is that something you played, or like, how did that end up in the book?
I did not play that personally. I think it's probably a little bit before my time. I had read about it and I was very interested in it.
Yeah, it's a fascinatingly bizarre game. I never really got very far in it because it's really frustrating in a lot of ways. But just to give you an idea, you know, you're this sort of cyborg guy, and you wake up and having I think that there's this like sort of animated scene where you see like a buzzsaw cutting your limbs off and stuff from a first person point of view. And then you wake up in a cell and you have these robot limbs, and then you go into the next cell and the guy in the cell next to you has tried to get out through the like laser bars, and his arm has gotten cut off, and you have to like pick up his arm and beat him to death with it. And it's just so weird. Like, so yeah, I don't know if anyone, probably no one else has ever heard of that.
No, I've heard of it. I've never played it.
Yeah, no, I never played it. Sorry.
But it's so funny. Like, I realize, yeah, I was just going to say, I realize like part of my over attachment to The Mist, the Stephen King story, is because I spent days and weeks and weeks playing The Mist computer game, which was a text-based game. It was like, oh my God, it's a computer game that's horror. Like, that, there wasn't a lot of that in 1987 or 6, you know? So it was like, and that really shaped how I thought about horror and how I thought about that story. But it's not a book. It's not a movie. You know, it really falls between the cracks.
That's like a really good point, though, that you made, Dave, about like not knowing what was popular like in the 80s or 90s. Because like now we just sort of solidify our opinions about what's popular and what isn't popular so quickly based on social media, and like we know immediately like what everyone else is into and what everyone else thinks about everything. But like the way we were encountering stuff then when we were younger, like it really was sort of in a vacuum, like how I was encountering my Sylvia Engdahl books. And I remember the title, by the way. It's This Star Shall Abide was the title of the book that blew my little mind. But yeah, I mean, I would have thought, oh, those are so popular, everyone must love those. And of course, you know, growing up and being a science fiction and fantasy writer, I really haven't hardly encountered anyone who's ever even heard of them.
Yeah, I mean, was your experience growing up, Des, that you, or did you feel sort of lonely and isolated being into fantasy and science fiction, or did you connect with other people over it?
You know, I had a really weird childhood, and I was basically very lonely and isolated regardless, so I don't know. I did not know any other science fiction or fantasy fans, but I didn't really know a lot of other children in general, because I was homeschooled.
Don't you have a bunch of siblings? Like, do you have, like, 4 siblings or something?
I have 5 siblings, so yeah.
But none of them were into fantasy and science fiction?
They're all younger than me, so they were at different reading stages, but yes, they actually are. Well, most of them, I think, are readers and were into science. Well, none of, like, Harry Potter type stuff, you know, the big stuff, Hunger Games, that kind of thing.
Did your sister do a piece of artwork for this book?
Yes, she did.
Wait, what'd she do?
So my sister is an artist. She's a professional art director. And she also does art. She used to be a printmaker, but now she does more painting and digital illustration. And she did a piece for the Angela Carter article.
Ah.
Yes.
That's cool.
I mean, yeah. You wanted to talk about Angela Carter, didn't you? Or?
Well, no, just in the context of that's someone who fantasy doesn't claim. And she's huge. I mean, The Bloody Chamber is one of the all-time great fantasy novels, period, full stop. And you don't see the genre claiming it as much as I wish they would, especially in the States. In the UK, I think she's a bigger deal. When she died, there were a lot of obituaries and articles about her, and the anniversary of her death always gets let's reassess Angela
it was
Carter.
Like Salman Rushdie and stuff. And I just know this from reading Lost Transmissions, but a bunch of like really big name literary authors eulogized her and stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's like, and The Bloody Chamber is so formative. And it's funny, the movie that was made out of one of the stories in there, in The Company of Wolves, the Neil Jordan movie, has really kind of, I'm not sure it's a great movie still. Like, I saw it recently. It doesn't hold up the way I remember it. But it's a movie that sticks with you. Images from that thing will just, you'll see them for the rest of your life. I saw it when it came out on video, like shortly after it came out in theaters. And like, you know, the people at this fancy party turning into wolves, the some of that forest imagery, it just really, like, sticks in your mind. It sinks its hooks into your little pink folds of your brain. But, like, I just don't see her getting the praise in the States that she does overseas. And I get it. She thought of herself as a literary fiction writer. The literary fiction genre really embraced her and celebrated her. It's where her awards came from. That's where her sales came from. And so it sticks in the craw, I think, when your genre to embrace someone like that. But she's huge. You know, I mean, her retelling of fairy tales in Bloody Chamber is just one of the most astonishing things you'll ever read.
I guess that's sort of an interesting issue of, you know, people can be overlooked within the fantasy and science fiction world, even though they're super famous,
yeah,
you know, by other standards.
I mean, you mentioned Hunger Games, and I feel like that's a perfect example. Like, Hunger Games is unabashedly science fiction, but, you know, I think it's a lot of it is just, like, who do you see at cons, and that kind of thing does influence who people think of as big genre and not.
Yeah.
Well, there's sort of a little bit of a, not a total separation, but there's certainly some level of separation between the YA science fiction and the adult science fiction.
That's true, too. Yeah.
Well, also, like, you know, Dave, you did a whole thing about the Myth series, the Robert Asprin series. And I remember, I mean, the Myth series were given to me by an older friend of mine who was, like, you know, like 15 years older than I was, who was, like, renting a room from my mom and living in our house. And, like, he wasn't a genre guy, but he liked fun stuff. And because they were funny, they really appealed to him, you know, and, like... Robert Asprin also did the Thieves World series, which I loved, which is really, I feel like, just forgotten now, you know? But I feel like some of these people who had that success but reached outside the genre, they don't get as beloved by the genre later on.
Yeah, I'll just to be clear, I wrote my piece that I wrote for Lost Transmissions is about Robert Asprin's Myth series of humorous fantasy novels, which were my absolute favorite books when I was sort of...
They're great. I tore through them. Yeah.
I thought you... Did you tell me once, Greta, that you don't like fantasy, qua fantasy,
yeah,
that much?
I'm not a fantasy guy. I just don't know enough about it. And also, I think Paul will identify with this. I think, Des, you're significantly younger than we are. But growing up, fantasy to me was every time I opened a magazine or a newspaper, there was a full-page ads for the Swords of Shannara. Like, and so I just sort of assumed fantasy was just knockoffs of Lord of the Rings. And my older sister was really into the Ill-Earth War series. And, like, I tried to read that. She left it behind Heinlein juveniles.
She was really into what?
The Ill-Earth. Isn't it called the Ill-Earth Wars?
I don't know. Who's by who?
Stephen Douglas, right?
I don't know if I know that.
So the Ill-Earth Wars was like... I'm trying to remember. Okay, I think the author was... Oh, Stephen Donaldson. He wrote three books.
Are you
books.
Talking about the...
The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant. Yeah. So I was like, well, so fantasy is like the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant and Swords of Shannara. That's just not my... And I tried to read Lord of the Rings as a kid when I was too young. I loved The Hobbit, and I just couldn't do it, man. It was too many proper nouns that I didn't understand. But, like you're saying, on the other hand, I love Piers Anthony. I love the Xanth books. I love the Myth books. I love the Thieves World books. So I was reading fantasy. It just didn't seem like fantasy to me because it was fun. And what I thought of as fantasy was really turgid, epic fantasy, right? Which was really popular in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. I want to get Paul back in here. Paul, do you have anything you just want to add to anything we've been saying?
No, it's funny. I mean, just, again, thinking of, like, you know, growing up in the 80s, I mean, my dad was actually, he was a big Tolkien fan. Like, he was, like, a part of some fan club. I remember he used to have a pin that said, Frodo Lives. and he would, you know, later as an adult, I found out he was smoking something other than tobacco. But, you know, he would sit around smoking a pipe. Yes, pipe weed often. But, like, his love for those books didn't really translate to me reading them necessarily. Again, it's almost embarrassing at times to admit, like, how late I really sort of, like, came to reading. I mean, I was always, like, you know, the good boy who, you know, would read what was assigned in high school. But other than that, I watched movies. And I'm trying to think, like, when did I don't even know if I knew, like, there were, like, specific genres. You know, like, I don't think I ever said, I was like, oh, this is a fantasy movie. To me, you know, in the 80s, it was like, oh, well, there was Conan. And then there were all these sort of, like, Conan almost, like, knockoffs, like Red Sonja and...
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mentioned Excalibur, like all these, like Sword the Sorcerer, which I have the vaguest memories of. It's almost to me in retrospect that the ones that really sort of stuck with me are the ones that sort of mix genre. You know, I mentioned Trancers, you know, was just like this weird stew of stuff. But I don't know. I think I was sort of like, you know, that sort of lost sort of the things that crept through the mainstream that get to me. Cause you know, I was the oldest. It wasn't like my siblings were showing me stuff. I didn't have, you know, very many friends at all. So it was like all these things I had to discover on my own. And there was no internet, you know, there was no newsletters for me to find these things. It was just things I would stumble upon. Yeah. So even like sci-fi, like I'm sort of laughing at myself because I wrote down like the Dennis Quaid 80s trilogy of sci-fi movies that I saw like a bunch of times. It was like one each year. Dreamscape.
I remember
Dreamscape where, you know, the government hired these psychics to go into the dreams of other people. And obviously because the government's involved, there's, you know, shadowy bad things happen. That was like 84. And then the next year was Enemy Mine with Dennis Quaid. And Lou Gossett Jr. And the year after that was probably my least favorite, even though it was probably the biggest budget of the three, is Inner Space. So,
oh my God. Yeah, I totally forgot there was a Dennis Quaid trilogy. You're
100% right. Yeah, and it's like my memories are watching those movies. You know, my sister was only 1 year younger, and she didn't have any interest in that stuff. My brother was 5 years younger, so he couldn't always like keep up with me. You know, so most of the time it was me watching these things, you know, by myself.
Yeah, I love Inner Space and Enemy Mine. I mean, I love those movies, you know. It was like that age, you know, you walk out of Inner Space, like, that was the best movie I've ever seen.
Oh, that's how I felt about Dreamscape. I was like, how could there be a movie better than this? Everything is in it.
Definitely. I mean, and again, Dreamscape has like hints of horror to it because some of the, you know, obviously some of the dreams are really nightmarish. And that was pre-Nightmare on Elm Street. And I do remember vividly that was one of the first, like, they had just come up with PG-13. Sorry, Des, from boring you with old man stories, but I remember thinking that movie was like a little bit extra, like, oh my gosh, I'm watching a PG-13 movie. But I was 13, so I'm like, okay, I can do it.
See, so actually, Des, so the interviews that are in the book, did you conduct those interviews yourself? Yes, I did. So, because I wanted to ask you about the John Shirley interview. So there's this part where he says, Sterling, Rucker, Shiner, and I walked out of a panel at a convention in Austin in protest to the jeers of the backwards, staid science fiction status quo.
Uh-huh.
Do you know anything? Is there any more to that story? I'm curious to know what exactly was going on that caused them to all walk out and all the fans were jeering at them. Do you have any idea?
You know, I don't know. And I don't remember that part now. It was so long ago.
Is there anything that you want to say about what it was like interviewing the different people that you interviewed? Did you interview them over the phone? Or?
No, I did the interviews in writing. I don't know.
How did you pick which people to interview?
You know, I interviewed the people who were willing to sit down and talk to me. I'm fans of a lot of these people. And Karen Joy Fowler especially is one of my favorite writers and who I think is like a perfect example of what we've been talking about, where her work kind of, you know, it's literary, but it's also fantasy and science fiction. And sometimes genre has been less eager to embrace that work, although I think they've come around. And she's kind of doubly interesting to me as a writer in connection with this book, because so much of her work is actually sort of about secret histories, because she's very interested in history and her work and sort of surfacing those little details that characterize life at certain places and times. And I just think she's an incredible writer and she's really influenced me. So I was really happy that she agreed to do the interview. And I think it's a very fantastic interview. John Shirley, I was especially interested in talking to because cyberpunk was one of my first big loves in science fiction. And when I was sort of just beginning to get into like real grown up science fiction, like as an adult in college, Neuromancer was that one of the first books that just like really opened up a whole bunch of other stuff to me. So John Shirley was very interesting to me as someone who William Gibson has kind of cited as an influence. And I know John Shirley is not as big of a name in science fiction or in cyberpunk as William Gibson is. But he was nevertheless very influential and foundational to that movement and that subgenre. So I was really interested in talking to him about that. And it is an interesting interview. I wish I could remember more about them walking out to the jeers. I don't know.
I'll just say also, just speaking of William Gibson, is that there's a William Gibson interview in the book as well.
Not an interview, but he wrote the foreword to a book by John Shirley, which we were able to get for this book. So, that kind of dovetails, because I talked to Shirley about early cyberpunk, and he had some, you know, memories about him and Gibson and other writers. And then I was also able to acquire Gibson's forward to one of the Shirley early cyberpunk books that Gibson had said was so sort of influential and foundational for him.
Were there any big challenges in terms of putting the book together, in terms of getting any pieces from anyone in particular, or like how did you make contact with all the people that you needed to?
I think, well, again, there's just so much stuff that could have been in the book that I would have liked to have in the book that we weren't able to get, at least this time. I would have loved to have some pieces by Ursula K. Le Guin, and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I did refer to and quote her piece about George MacDonald, who is another writer that I really, really admired and found very foundational for my own canon. But her estate wasn't really willing to license those pieces right now, so that didn't happen. That's fair. That's their prerogative. And I'm sure there were, you know, a few others like that. There was some art I really wanted to get for the book. I really wanted to get some artwork by Mobius, there is a section about Mobius in the book, written by Meg Ellison. And I love his work. There was a lot of pieces that I hoped I'd be able to include. But again, I was just not able to successfully get in touch with his estate to get that licensed. And so we were not able to include it.
Grady, were you trying to say something?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, one of the things about just talking about John Shirley, he also wrote some really influential early horror novels like Dracula and Love and Sellers, which are great, and Wet Bones, but have been really sort of forgotten now. And it's weird. He was big in more than one genre.
I mean, he sounded like a pretty interesting character just from reading this interview.
But Des, I like
He's
that you were into cyber.
Too, yeah.
Yeah, I like that you're into cyberpunk. Did you ever read the Walter John Williams Hardwired, which was that early cyberpunk novel that, like, it didn't quite make the jump technologically? It was like people could jack into the web at, like, payphones, and they had, like, belt faxes.
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure.
Oh, my God. That thing was huge for me, because I was like, yeah, Neuromancer's fine, but it's pretty dense. But, like, Hardwired has, like, cars and guns, and, yeah, of course you're going to have a belt fax. That's what the future's going to be like.
One of, I think, the best early cyberpunk novels, or I don't know if it's early, but foundational, was Sinners by Pat Cadigan. And that's another
one
that doesn't get, it's been a while, but as I recall, they did have they have like ports, you know, at the back of their skulls where they can jack in.
Screw Bluetooth.
Yeah. And there's just like a lot of weird body stuff and like just artificial reality and synthetic experience. And it's a big complex novel. And I really liked it. I read it a couple times when I was much younger. And that's another one that I think should definitely get more play in the cyberpunk canon, at least.
I mean, when you mention John Shirley being a musician, that makes me think that there's a lot of stuff in the book beyond just books and movies, right? There's like stuff that, you know, was pretty new to me, like fashion and architecture and music. I guess you mentioned some of that earlier, but is there anything you want to... Let's talk about the fashion, because I don't know that I ever had a conversation about science fiction fashion before. Kind of what was the impetus for putting that section in the book?
Well, you know, I think it's so important because fashion as a whole is kind of part of that secret history. It's like what we're saying, like there is a very clear like history of science fiction fashion that we sort of try to trace in that chapter. But it's something that a lot of science fiction fans would think is not important. But like, nevertheless, like you remember the costuming of those characters that you saw in TV and movies that were, you know, formative for you. And also a lot of actual fashion trends, like stuff that people wear in real life, or at least wear, you know, in high fashion or catwalks or whatever, it is influenced by that forward-looking visual aesthetic that is being shaped by whatever the science fiction storytelling of the day is. And so I think that's really fascinating. But it's like one of those things where would we act like fashion is a lesser, unimportant aspect of genre? We are making decisions about who's important and whose interests matter. And I think that, like, by kind of bringing science fiction fashion back into the fold of this story, it's a way to kind of center something that, like, maybe women or just more feminine people in general are more interested in, and kind of like put it back on the same level as this other stuff and say, like, it's equally important. It's an equally crucial and valuable art form. And the way that fashion plays into the aesthetic of all these other concepts is, like, important and matters and is an essential part of that storytelling.
Yeah, some high-end designer had done all the costumes for Fifth Element. I never knew that.
Who was it?
Oh, Gautier, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you could really see in, like, in the design of Fifth Element. I mean, that's just, there's so much going on visually in that movie, and, like, that's just one part of it, but, like, it's an important part, and, like, that deserves to be surfaced.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's also, there's a huge thing where, out of the 80s, where Klaus, like, I was really happy to see Alexander McQueen in here, because I think he straddles that world. And there was a thing in the 80s and early 90s, especially, when there were a lot of drag queens who were doing really avant-garde kind of fashion stuff. I mean, the first one that comes to mind, he's not really a drag queen, but Klaus Nomi, you know, who was the performance artist in the early 80s. Or you look at Laurie Anderson in the 80s, you know, this real intersection in performance and gender performance and, you know, the drag culture and performance art and science fiction. There was a lot of, like, overlap there. And I think it's a shame when, like, you know, there's stuff to be mined from that. You know, there's influence to be found.
Yeah, absolutely. So architecture is another chapter that I think maybe is a little bit uncommon to consider as far as science fiction and fantasy. But I think the architecture really kind of sprang out of my own personal interest and obsession. Like, that's my influence on how the book came together. Because I personally have always been so interested in thinking about like the built environment and habitats and spaces and cities. So I try to make the case in the book that those sort of urban planners and those people who are really, like, very conceptually oriented, thinking about the built environment, that they were also, in a way, science fiction storytellers. And you definitely see the influence of those concepts in a lot of science fiction movies and television. And then I think that also kind of trickles down to a lot of science fiction novels, and even fantasy too, because, you know, just those putting forth those, like, really imaginative visions of how humans can live in a built environment is just, like, the way that we interact with our space, like, shapes how we live so much. And it's so much of, like, creating of world building, like creating an alternate world, whether it's fantasy or sci-fi.
Well, also, you know, you look at the architecture, look at Frank Lloyd Wright stuff that got used and repurposed for Blade Runner. Like, you go in a Frank Lloyd Wright house, some of them now, and you feel like you're in Blade Runner because you see some of the same things. Or Corbusier and his furniture and things that got used in movies and, like, appeared all over the place, and his ideas and theories. Like, I agree. I think there's a huge overlap there. Architects often are thinking about the future.
I want to get Paul back in here. So, I mean, one thing that's in the book a lot is there's a lot about music and these concept albums and stuff. And it seems like maybe it's just because Stephen King is so popular and he loves music so much and puts so much of it in his book. But I don't know. Are you a big music person, or do you think that there's sort of a lot of overlap between music and horror writing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm a frustrated musician at heart. I wanted to be a punk metal guitar player before I became a writer. You know, unfortunately, I found out I was a better writer than musician. and I will playfully say that I stalk many of my favorite bands with my writing, and I've been able to actually become friendly with, you know, quite a few of my favorite bands.
You stalk them with your writing?
Well, you know, I'll say, hey, I'm a fan of your stuff, and I send them a book, and, you know, more times than not, like, you know, these musicians are readers too, and and actually so many of them read genre. So I was actually, it's funny that you're going to ask me about music, because I was, as I'm perusing the table of contents in the music section, was like, oh, you know, if I were ever, there's a volume two, you know, I could write about a band called Clutch, an American band who started off sort of like a hardcore metal, but have sort of morphed more into like straight ahead rock. But their first, their breakthrough record, you know, there's a song about, you know, the Star Wars bar scene, and, you know, there's all sorts of science fictional elements. And in a most recent, their album, like two records ago, you know, there's a song about Philip K. Dick. And, yeah. So, I mean, I love the, you know, music influencing genre and vice versa.
What is the gist of the Philip K. Dick song?
What the heck is the name of the song? Why am I, this is terrible when I'm put on the spot. I should have written it down. Well, I mean, the song is very in the style of Philip K. Dick. Sort of like it's a paranoid person in a motel room. And if you watch the video, they actually sneak in like a little picture of, it's called X-ray Vision. There we go. Ooh. yeah. X-ray Visions. And that's the name of the record as well. Yeah. And so when I actually reached out, you know, years ago to talk to Neil Fallon, who's the, you know, the lead vocalist and lyricist, you know, he talked about how he used to use the Nebulas as his like reading list. So it's been actually quite a bit of fun to see like all these different bands, you know, usually more sort of punk, heavier indie kind of thing, you know, who do read genre. So to me, that's been like a really rewarding, unexpectedly rewarding experience.
Do you know other horror writers who are frustrated musicians?
That's crazy. Yeah, there's a bunch that I know that play guitar. Well, I mean, Josh Malerman has a band. You know, he was in a band before, you know, he sort of broke big with writing. Like, he's still in that band. There's even more. There's another writer, I think, who sort of straddles the line of genre. I think, you know, if we're talking about like who genre takes and who doesn't take, but, John, I'm going to say his last name, right? Darnell of the Mountain Goats. Is that his name?
Yeah.
So, I mean, his novel Wolf in the White Van is really about like a kid who plays like Dungeons and Dragons. It becomes a big important part of the book. You know, he wrote a book called, Universal Harvester, which really sort of skirts the line of horror. He even wrote for the music essay little tiny book series 33 and a third. He wrote a novella about Black Sabbath's
it's amazing
master of reality, right?
Yeah.
And I that's the favorite thing of his that he's written.
me too. I thought it was real when I first read it. I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
So can you tell me about that? I've read his two novels, but I don't know what you're talking about with that Black Sabbath thing.
Yeah. So I forget the publisher, but they have this whole series of books called 33 and a third, where someone will write about an entire record. And as far as I know, all of them have been, you know, nonfictional, where they're talking about, you know, Neutral Milk Hotel album or, you know, another sort of famous record. Mm-hmm. And his is, you know, it's fiction, but it's fiction that, you know, where the Black Sabbath record becomes important to the story. And it's, you know, it really starts off about this angry kid. You know, he's got a terrible job and like, you know, he ends up sort of like, in a mental hospital, like no one believes him, but it sort of goes through, sort of follows the record a little bit. I don't want to like say too much for spoiling it, but
yeah,
it's really incredible. If you cared about, like, I really cared about music when I was a kid. It was the most important thing to me. And this is like, if you cared about music that much when you were a teenager, this is right for you.
So were you ever in a band, Grady?
Never, because I'm very unmusical. But, you know, I wrote We Sold Our Souls, which is like a heavy metal horror novel, and it sells significantly less than everything else I've ever written. And my agent was like, every author wants to write a rock and roll book, and it's the job of every agent to stop them.
Well, I don't know if there's this great line. So George R. R. Martin, he was actually a rock and roll journalist early in his career.
Yeah.
And his fourth novel is this book called Armageddon Rag, which has destroyed his career. It sold
killed
badly.
It.
And that's why he had to go to Hollywood, because he couldn't sell books anymore. But so he said one time, he said, you know, I thought it would be great because it was going to be a mix of fantasy and horror and rock and roll, and it would appeal to fans of all three of those. And what I didn't take into account is that there was too much horror for the fantasy fans and too much fantasy for the horror fans, and rock and roll fans don't read.
Yeah.
Man, I don't want to go too far afield, but it gets so hard to write about music and fiction. And I typically don't enjoy it. And I think the only people who are more snobby than genre fans are hardcore music fans. Cause I mean, that's my initial reaction. I mean, like, you know, I don't know, like as Grady mentioned, to me, music, you know, aside from, you know, watching movies every day, I came home from school, I would lay on the floor with the speakers tented over my head, you know, and make up videos. If I wasn't imagining myself performing,
yes,
I was making up like actually really weird sci-fi kind of videos for the songs that I was listening to. Yeah. So typically when I read something that involves music, it's like, this is really inauthentic. And my inner music snob really comes out. And it's hard to control the music snob part of things.
I mean, Des, were you ever in a band or anything?
No, I did used to sing a little bit, but no longer.
Did you, was the music stuff in the book, is that mostly because Jason Heller was involved, or was that your interest as well?
I mean, a little bit of both. I think that he probably, suggested some of the topics originally, but then, you know, since he ended up not being involved, I wrote what was there that was not made by contributors. And some of them were definitely my interest too. Like, I was super psyched to include the piece about Porcupine Tree because I have been a fan of that band for a really long time. And I was really, really excited about the Janelle Monáe piece.
Because
that was one of the main pieces, just like from the beginning of the book, I knew I wanted to have in the book was something about Janelle Monáe. So that was like a must have. And then, of course, John Chu wrote an amazing piece about speculative fiction musical theater, which I barely even knew was a thing. But that's a great piece. There's just like, you know, some things like that, whereas kind of a couple of them were my interests and a lot of it was driven by what the contributors were interested in. Oh, another great piece in that section is the Deltron 3030 piece. That's another, I've been a fan of Deltron 3030 for a really long time. So I was super excited when Marco Shiro said that he wanted to write about them. And I was like, yes, let's do it.
So you're running a little short on time. I think, Grady, you said that you wanted to talk about World War III movies.
No, it's fine. It's if we had 3 hours, totally. You know, so but
do
also,
just,
yeah.
Do you want to just say, Grady, like, are there other things, like, if you hadn't written about post-apocalyptic, were there other topics that you were considering or that you would want to write more about that would fit this topic?
Well, you know, I mean, there's so much stuff. I mean, like, you know, I would have loved to have written about all the World War II movies, or all World War III movies that came out in, like, 83, 84 at the height, like, the day after, and Special Bulletin, and Red Dawn, and Testament, and Threads, and War Games. I mean, they were huge, and they're all sci-fi. They're all imagining a war that didn't happen, but we were convinced was going to. Or, like, you know, you look at Dave Mustaine and Megadeth, and his, like, weird swerve towards these, like, bizarre New World Order fantasies on his albums, or like, you know, the Black Israelites, you know, which I know is just sort of the slang term for them, but they're these real big, like, you know, that the sort of conspiracy theory /religious belief /conspiracy theories that are like, you know, black people descended from, you know, aliens who came down and formed ancient Egypt and their UFOs and built the pyramids and were waiting for the mothership. You know, Sun Ra and all, there's so much stuff. Like, I really wish there was going to be another one of these because there's so much stuff and a lot of it straddles genres. And I think it's important because the same way that there's, as Paul was saying, too much fantasy for the metal fan, for the music fans, too much like music for the fantasy fans. Like, but people I think are much more open-minded and the genre borders are much more porous now. And I think people want to know that stuff. And I think it takes people from one genre to another now.
See, Paul, is there anything else that you wanted to, that you would be interested in writing about on this topic?
Oh, yeah. I mean, any of the things I talked about, I was also thinking it would be kind of fun to talk about, even though it's, I guess, nominally a nonfiction show, but it didn't really feel like a nonfiction television show, but In Search Of. You know,
oh, yeah.
Hosted by Leonard Nimoy. I was so riveted to that show as a child. Mm-hmm. Also frightened by it, and it had this weird gravitas because it was Leonard Nimoy. My father, again, like the other, I mean, I guess he was the genre fan in the house because he was a big Star Trek fan. I mean, I watch it a little with him occasionally, but not a ton. But No, In Search Of, I would watch the hell out of that show.
Yeah.
And you know, that just even the theme song, I feel like they could write about it. And no, I think that totally, you know, again, people of our age, I mean, I think that was a, that had some ripples to it. Just the, you know, the thing, you know, just that they would, you know, discuss UFOs or, you know, Loch Ness Monster and the other, you know, just the weird stuff that they would discuss.
So, Des, do you think you might never do another book like this?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I think it probably depends how many people buy this one.
So if everybody listening to this just goes out and buys a copy of Lost Transmissions by Desirina Boscovich,
I was going to, absolutely. It's an impressive achievement. Like, I mean, I didn't realize, you know, until, you know, I have the book and I've read most of it, but looking at the email of the table of contents, it's like, it's striking how much Desirina wrote for this. I can't imagine the amount of work that you put into this. It's, I mean,
it was a lot of work.
You write fiction
it took
too,
a couple years, but
yeah. I mean, did take away from the fiction writing? I don't want to say take away, but like, did you finish this? You're like, oh my God, I'm totally exhausted. I never want to write another essay again. Or
no, I mean, I would love to do another book like this. I think it'd be amazing. I mean, it's just really just, you know, I think, you know, of course there would be realities of publishing. I think it really does depend on if this one sells well or not. Right. Maybe the publishers would be up for another. I don't know. I haven't asked them, but it really is kind of always just driven by what's the market interested in.
Right.
But I personally would think it'd be amazing to do another one.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's a beautiful book. I mean, just as an artifact, the book is stunning with, you know, the artwork that goes with all the essays and, you know, obviously the art section. I mean, it's a stunning book. I mean, you are to be congratulated.
Well, actually, I should give a shout out to the designer for the book, Jacob Covey, because he's the one that, you know, designed the book, and the gorgeousness of the book is 100% due to his work, and he really did a fantastic and amazing job. It was really a delight to be able to work with him on that and just like see what he came up with for like all those spreads, because you know he's really accomplished and he's fantastic. So yeah, the credit for that really goes to him.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that the book is just gorgeous. I mean, Des says it's a coffee table book, but it really is. It's a, you know, hardcover, lots of illustrations and everything. And, you know, just having written stuff for lots of different books in fantasy and science fiction and horror, they're not always the best looking books. I hate to say that.
Yep.
But this is just absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, like we should definitely, you know, draw attention to that.
Yeah. And also I would like to give a shout out to, the artist, Paul Lair, who created the art that's on the cover, which is so, I feel like, so essential to the character of the book. And there's another piece by Paul Lair in the interior of the book as well. And so he has since passed away. So I worked with his daughter to acquire those pieces. And I absolutely adore them, and I wish I could have gotten even more. And he's another artist who there has not yet been a comprehensive retrospective of his life work. But he's so talented and his work is so beautiful and atmospheric. I think there absolutely should be just a, Paul Lair art book with just, all of his work. And I would love to see that happen. And I know his family would too. So I hope that's something else that, the market can kind of support over the next few years, because I just think that would be fabulous.
Yeah, cool. All right, I got a couple of suggestions from listeners of overlooked science fiction and fantasy that I want to read. So I'm not sure how to pronounce this name. Vibeek Venomo Durhal says, Hugh Cook's work is not talked about as much as he deserves, I think. His work was weird before weird became a genre, and he draws his characters with batty cynicism. Some of his characters are also quite bratty cynics. He has titles like The Wicked and The Witless, Amazing Worlds Building 2. Alice Ambrose says, have any of you read the novels of Rachel Neumeier? She's still active, but I think she deserves way more attention, i.e. a lot of my friends haven't heard of her. She wrote the Griffin Mage trilogy, The Floating Islands, and The City in the Lake, among others. And Gray Sky Farm says, The Dhamma and Vedia stories by David Drake. I don't know if anyone's familiar with any of those. I'll confess, I'm not. I mean,
I don't know any of them.
Drake, but not those stories. But yeah, so people can check those out. All right, cool. So any other Any other final thoughts or anything? Grady, you have any final thoughts?
No, man. I mean, this is just an essential book, and people need to buy it because I want to write something for the next one.
No, absolutely. I mean, as we said, gorgeous book, and I've enjoyed reading it, and I've almost had as much fun, you know, making up a list of other things that could be in the next one. But everyone, go buy it.
All right, so I guess, Des, you get the final word.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, you know, I just want to say this book was absolutely a group effort, and, you know, that's obvious looking at the table of contents. And I did write a lot for the book, but there are so many other contributors who wrote amazing pieces about stuff I never even knew about. And I learned so much from working on the book just because I got to read all those pieces by contributors. And I know we didn't get a chance to say all their names or talk about all their essays in this brief conversation, but they're really all very, very good. So I would say buy the book just so you can read all those essays by many of the best writers in genre today.
Yeah, absolutely. And so once again, the book is called Lost Transmissions by Desiree Noboskovich. And so I just want to thank everyone for joining us. We've been speaking with Desiree Noboskovich, Grady Hendrix, and Paul Tremblay. So thanks to everyone so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Aloha.
And that was our panel. So big thanks again to Desiree Noboskovich, Paul Tremblay, and Grady Hendrix for joining us on the show. And remember that Geek's Guide to the Galaxy is made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. So if you enjoy the show and want it to continue, please sign up to give us a dollar or two per episode over at patreon.com/geeks. And if you'd rather make a one-time contribution, you can do that via check or PayPal over at geeksguideshow.com/crowdfunding. So big thanks again to everyone who's contributed. We really appreciate it. All right, so that was our show. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Geek's Guide to the Galaxy is a production of Wired.com. For more information about the show, visit geeksguideshow.com. To learn more about your host, visit davidbarrkirtley.com. Music and voiceover produced by yours truly, Jack Kincaid. If you enjoyed this program, tell your friends. If you didn't enjoy it, tell no one. Thank you for listening.